Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Modern Retail Podcast. I'm Cale Guthrie-Weissman, the editor-in-chief of Modern Retail. And this week, I'm really excited. We have Matt Alexander. He's the co-founder and CEO of Neighborhood Goods. And for those who are listening and not sitting in front of me, we are in the Neighborhood Goods Chelsea Market location, which it's cool to be in person at a thing. Also, be cool to be in such a space. I know this is an audio program, but I'm like truly in front of a retail display among a bustling store, and it's a really fun environment. We're gonna go into the store, the business, all that jazz, how things have been going and evolving over the last few years. But Matt, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you so much for having me.
Absolutely. So first, for those who don't know, do you want to just give a little bit of background about who you are, sort of how you got into the quasi, I guess, updated department store space?
I've been in retail for the past almost decade at this point, but started Neighborhood Goods back in, it was incorporated in 2017. We opened our first location in the suburbs of Dallas in November 2018, with the core sort of premise of creating a space that could sort of allow for brands to sort of enter physical retail, accomplish a broad variety of goals, whether it's customer acquisition, product testing, generating sales, obviously, but really trying to learn more and more about what it takes to run their own spaces or otherwise. And so what that could look like all in one space. So for the consumer, something that sort of feels somewhat traditional and familiar in the same vein as a department store, but from a back-end perspective, running on a much more progressive economic and logistics engine that would then allow for a very inexpensive way to test physical, much more straightforward than opening your own pop-up, much more dignified than going into a lot of wholesale relationships and marketplace relationships, and something that wouldn't necessarily lock you in and might be a more sort of modern way of approaching it. So we have three locations, one in Plano, the one here, and then one in Austin, with more on the way. And that's really the basis of it. So we're, you know, on the surface, we're often described as working with predominantly direct to consumer brands and things of that nature. But we also work with a lot of traditional brands as well. And so we've worked with brands like Aesop and Aston Martin and all sorts of others, as well as working with brand new upstart brands. We have a not-for-profit initiative we launched during the pandemic called The Commons, where we give away free space to brands that have been initially hard hit by the pandemic. And we brought it back last year, largely targeting brands that are sort of underrepresented. And we have all sorts of other initiatives. So at any given time, usually over 50% of our brands are female-founded. We have a big initiative around Black-owned brands and all sorts of initiatives around sustainability and otherwise. So the end result is something that feels like a boutique sort of department store. But obviously there's a lot more to it. Than
Aston Martin, you sold cars there?
No. Yeah, it was a strange one. They parked their cars outside the store in Plano, and we had some of their merch inside, which is wildly off-brand, but it was good fun. And I think our general philosophy is, if you listened into like a lot of our calls internally, we talk a lot about the why of being so important, but at the same time, it's also the why not. And I think it's really easy to find yourself in a really prescriptive mindset and sort of say, we're definitively not doing X, Y, Z, but you end up sort of precluding yourselves from lots of opportunities and interesting conversations. And so we're very much of this sort of mindset where we want to just sort of be playful and sort of take opportunities as and when they arise. And so that is a good example of one that sort of came up and was sort of, we had never thought about that before, but an interesting experiment.
So I want to start at the start. When you first launched, because I'm looking at the shop now, it's filled with all types of things. Mustard greens, I'm pretty sure, are directly in front of me. And then there's also clothes, olive oil. You span categories. What were the categories you first launched in? And what were they, DTC brands? And was it a hard sell to say, we're opening a store in Plano?
So we launched, first of all, we launched with the general premise that we would have brands with 100 to 500 square feet each.
Okay.
So our first store in Plano, we expected to launch with 10 to 15 brands, and we launched with about 26. And the main thing that changed was that a lot of them were quite keen to be sort of integrated into the space. So Framebridge framed artwork on the walls, Sonos put speakers in the ceilings, things of that nature. The pitch was, you know, I was sort of preemptively embarrassed about saying Plano. And so I sort of say, where's the first store going to be? I was like, well, it's in North Texas, near Dallas, sort of thing, and sort of steadily make my way into it. But it's actually, it was a relatively easy sell in the end, because a lot of these brands, you know, Dallas, Fort Worth in general tends to be in the top five or at worst top 10 markets for most direct consumer brands. A lot of the dollars originate in Plano. It was at the time the third fastest growing city in the country. Toyota just moved their North American headquarters there, and just it's the home to a huge number of people. And so really hungry audience, don't have particular access to a lot of these sorts of brands. And so for the brands we work with, we're often helping them with customer acquisition, right? And so for them to be able to get to customers earlier in their life cycle, potentially before some of their competitors, it's much less expensive than running XYZ ad campaign. So Plano actually became really popular. And so the categories are relatively consistent. The one big difference I would say is we're sort of sitting in and amongst CPG products. Yeah. And so that was an introduction we made during the pandemic, where we saw a lot of opportunity with a lot of these different sort of upstart CPG brands. One of the big things they lost during the pandemic was sampling. And so they're trying to get in front of people. They might try to get a relationship with a Whole Foods or whatever it is, but with pandemic protocols, they weren't able to give away samples. So it was really hard to get in front of people. And so we started to take some of these products in and integrate them into our restaurants and started to come up with really fun non-linear ways of introducing them. So with Fly By Jing, which is otherwise a seasoning for food, yeah, we did a cocktail with them. With Parlor Coffee, which is obviously coffee, we did a coffee rub burger. And it's sort of this playful approach of sort of leveraging Neighborhood Goods, the space, as its own influencer of sorts. And you sort of build these sort of adjacencies, right? So you go into our space in Austin and you're shopping Aesop, and there's all these interesting people shopping around, and there's people sitting around the bar, and it creates these different interesting opportunities that create a lot of brand value for the people involved. But aside from that, we've always represented most of the same things, you know, beauty and wellness, apparel, kids, home, et cetera. And it bends and flexes at any given time. But the big difference is that today in most of our stores, you know, 26 when we first opened in Plano, that store today has 154 brands in it or thereabouts at any given time. And this store is somewhere similar, over 100. And so we've ended up with these much more sort of competitive categories. And so, you know, we just, you know, just prior to this, heard from the founders of Maud and Act in Africa and a number of these other brands where they're all integrated into the same section, but they might have something more distinct and robust in one of the Texas spaces. And so we just sort of play in different environments.
Makes sense. So the last time I talked with you, I believe it was June of 20, or it wasn't the last time, but the last time we were doing an interview like this, June of 2020, the world had gone to hell. And I think pretty much the thrust of the conversation was just like, all of the knee-jerk changes you had to make as part of a store that was a predominantly like retail-facing, consumer-facing store business model. So give sort of a context for those here. What, like, how did the business model of Neighborhood Goods change as a result of the pandemic? And then today, what of that has been a longstanding, you know, what of those big quick changes are now part of the real strategy that you have in place?
Yeah, so core model, brands typically pay to be in the store, and then we take a revenue share, typically. And there's variety there. And then we own the restaurants. We develop those in-house. So that's also us. And then we have our own private label. We do lots of exclusives and things like that. So that's ours too. Pandemic came along. This store was 2 or 3 months old. Our store in Austin was open for less than 24 hours when I made the decision to close. So it opened on March 13th, 2020. And then I made the decision to close on the afternoon of March 14th. Which was rough. yeah, it was a tough time. You know, we immediately, you know, a lot of the brands pay us fees, right? So we immediately just stopped charging. We went through layoffs and furloughs, all sorts of challenging things. And we'd come into the year on a real tear, and it was just really sort of gut wrenching to suddenly be in that moment. And obviously we weren't alone. What we found very quickly was that a lot of our brands hadn't opted into being online with us. There was a concern about sort of cannibalizing their own businesses and otherwise. And so digital for us was more informational. But we started hearing from a lot of them that they wanted to be online. And one of the big things was that a lot of the brands obviously started to really struggle with supply chain. Our stores are ostensibly their own warehouses. And so local delivery, same day delivery, sort of in-store pickup, things of that nature, we were able to offer that for products that were otherwise going to take weeks, if not months, to arrive with customers. And so that actually became a real driver for us. the restaurants actually became a very interesting hotbed of creativity as well, where we started to work with delivery-only restaurant concepts to activate in our restaurants. So we had like Sandoichi come into our space in Plano and Austin. We had 8 Mile Pies, all these different sort of concepts come in, and people were queuing up and having all these like really fun activations around it. And so we just got really creative. So we were closed for 90 days in Texas, 130 days in New York or thereabouts. And so we waited beyond sort of restrictions being lifted to make sure we were sort of comfortable. Obviously in a place like New York, there's lots of dynamics where a lot of the folks that work in the stores, they commute from further out. And sort of, you want to make sure everyone's sort of, comfortable coming in. And so obviously lots of different complexity, but the core model remained the same. We just sort of came back and we sort of slowly found our way back into charging fees again with brands. We started to bring more brands in. We started to see a lot more demand than we had sort of expected for that period. And then what we generally saw was traffic was lower than what we were accustomed to from pre-pandemic, but conversion was way up. And so productivity was down, but not sort of radically so, not sort of catastrophically so. And so we had raised money just before the pandemic, and so we haven't raised money since. And we just sort of really doubled down on what we could do to really sort of improve our core fundamentals. And so we have 3 stores in great locations with great brands. We doubled down on our website. So the version that was online from like early May to like the end of last year, I developed from my house during the pandemic. I just like rewrote our site. And so the new version is much more professional. But we just got really scrappy. And so we today are in the similar sort of mindset where we're looking ahead, but we're wanting to be really responsible. I think one of the things we had seen was that we had a few brands that did sort of like just disproportionately well previously, that really sort of were like a huge component of the revenue mix. And it became much more democratized and equal on the other side of that sort of period of closures. And we launched the Commons that I mentioned earlier. And so I think we just built this sort of moment where I think we just tried to really sort of focus on building trust with brands, with consumers. We wanted to be really thoughtful about safety. We wanted to be really thoughtful about curation. We wanted to be really thoughtful about, you know, a core sort of element of our philosophy is allowing the customers to dictate the terms as to how they want to transact with us. So whether they want to shop online and pick up, whether they want to come in and shop themselves, whether they want to shop completely on their own and not talk to staff, whatever it is. And so, you know, I think at the end of the day, the vision, the concept, the model all remains 100% the same. It's just, I think it really forced us to really become much more introspective. And I think we had sort of just been careening forward. And I think we probably would have had some sort of debt come due from that at some point in 2020, 2021. And it's not to say that like it won't at some point in future, but we just sort of, I think, found the way forward and sort of took more control over our own destiny. And so it's worked out well for us. I mean, the stores have been doing really well, and we've got great teams across all of them. And so
that's great. You mentioned pre-pandemic, there were certain brands that did disproportionately better than others. What types of products were the ones that did the numbers?
It would just be like, you know, like cult hit brands. Like Rothy's, we were one of their first physical retail partners, and they launched in our Plano store in May of 2019. So we were 6 months old or thereabouts. And they launched, and they have this self-organized audience that really cares about Rothy's. They all get together on Facebook and talk about it seriously. And so it was the first and only place you could see them in person in Texas, right? And so people that had never met each other all road trip together to the store, having met on Facebook, to come shop Rothy's. And they would come spend, you know, $10,000 buying SKUs that were otherwise sold out online. And then there's this whole secondary market of Rothy's that they would then sell on Facebook and whatever else. And so we would have people like queuing up outside the store for brands like that. And so we've had the same thing. We've had great brands over the years. We work with incredible partners. We launched with, you know, Stadium Goods that had queues everywhere, and otherwise their only physical is here. Buck Mason, who otherwise don't do any sort of distribution through any other channels. all sorts. We've done like exclusives and like customization with brands like Huyana. We work with all sorts that otherwise you're not really going to find in many other locations. So you still have brands that will have a moment, especially given sort of seasonality and different moments of different customer taste, where they'll sort of race ahead. But it's just much more sort of equal now. And I think it's sort of a reflection of the fact that we have a more sort of even mix across different categories. And so back then, you know, Rothy's was one of 30 brands in the store. And so if they came back, it would probably look a lot different now in context of all these different spaces. And so, it's just sort of, I think, the maturity of the customer. And in that time, it was certainly the novelty piece as well, where it was like, wow, like you've never seen a lot of these things in person and I can shop this and have a glass of wine and there's like live music and Serena Williams is here for some reason. And it's just sort of interesting.
You mentioned earlier that, I love that, Serena Williams is just here. Of course she is. You mentioned that when things began opening back up, foot traffic was down, conversions were up. Was that just a result of more, what? Like I feel like when you're in Chelsea Market specifically, it is tourist central. It is teeming with people from out of town. So were there a lot of locals who were venturing out and like, I'm gonna go here? Has that proven out? Are you seeing more? Is there a different type of customer that's coming in now than there was pre-2020?
Well, today traffic is ridiculously strong. Yeah. Like it's like this location is above what we were seeing before the pandemic, and we're just getting an absurd amount of people to the point that it creates like a lot of challenges as to how you operate with it. You know, I think what happened during the pandemic was people just became much more intentional and it became more of this sort of celebratory, sort of ceremonial moment when you went to go to a store or whatever it was. And so we saw in particular F&B grow a lot for us, which had never been, we never saw it as this big sort of revenue channel for us, but always something to augment the broader experience. But it became much more of its own standalone aspect where people were coming in clearly to like buy themselves something nice with a real sort of focus on that and then would have a drink or lunch or whatever it was. And so the stores were productive, just fewer people coming in. And so you had those moments. What's changed since is traffic has come back, but conversion has sort of held steady.
Really? So that's
and so that obviously works out favorably. And so, you know, it creates an interesting dynamic. I think the thesis for us was always that you would probably come in for the first time because you really care about XYZ brand that you've never been able to see in person before. Then you get excited and then you keep coming back because you had a good experience and you get hooked on others or you had a great experience at the restaurant, whatever it is. And that sort of creates this magnetism. And I think we're seeing that play out. So we have really strong repeat purchase rate. We have a lot of customers that are coming in on a regular sort of basis. And then there's obviously, yes, the tourists have come back. I think during the pandemic, I think locals were able to come back to Chelsea Market at the weekend for the first time in years because they weren't sort of afraid of just like the raw humanity. So there's just a lot of different dynamics at play. At the end of the day, for us, it means that sales have continued to grow and we continue to add more brands. And there's obviously a lot of nuance to all those different aspects. But at the end of the day, the fundamental picture just continues to improve.
So talk about the F&B side of things. How has that strategy evolved? Are you putting more resources into it now? Do you consider this just to be as more of a hangout spot than it was when you first started as a result of that?
I think we're still sort of finding the right path. I think it plays out differently in different locations. I think what we have, our thesis around real estate has always been that there's really five different types we'll do. So there's major metropolitan, like this store, Chelsea. Then there's up and coming, like what we have on South Congress in Austin. Then there's suburban, like what we have in Plano. Then there's malls, which we haven't done. And then there's seasonal and international, which we haven't done. If you then look at the reasons why brands would show up with us, it's, you know, generating sales, customer acquisition, et cetera, et cetera. And then you attribute value to each of those and you tally it, you would find that up and coming markets like Austin are generally right at the top. And then suburban and metropolitan are right behind. Malls are usually last, and it's not an indictment of malls, easy to pick on them, but it's just more that it's a very specific use case. And then seasonal and international can actually be right at the top, depending on the scenario. And so you think of F&B in context of those, it's really you're thinking about it in context of like, what are people doing around that sort of type of location? And so the vision for our restaurant here was always that it was meant to speak to a commuting audience. You know, we've got YouTube upstairs and all these other pieces, and we've just never been open really when that's been an element. This restaurant opened 10 months into 2020. And so we were already, the restaurant here has only existed during the pandemic and it's been growing really well. But like, it just, there's a lot of different sort of nuance there. And then meanwhile in Austin, you got the first Equinox in Texas above us, sorry, in Austin right above us. You've got the first Soho House in Texas right next door. You've got all these different dynamics. And so it just creates different sort of flows of people. So for some, it's more about like stopping in and grabbing and going, which was very much the concept here. Whereas in Austin, it's more about hanging out, having drinks, socializing, etc. So I think for us, it's an ongoing experiment, an ongoing dialogue, and an ongoing question. But we see it as an increasingly important piece. It's just, I think there's more work for us to do to work out the right balance of things. And I think really it's sort of getting back into the throw of events like this that we'll really sort of learn a lot more.
How are you rethinking overall footprint and design? So I imagine people started interacting differently with stores, you know, a few years ago. Now maybe they're more or less back to normal, but I see things that I haven't seen before. A lot of places have QR displays, for example, or things like, so how is that? How are you thinking about that?
Yeah, I mean, we were already doing a lot of that stuff. I think QR codes are kind of like the big victor of the past 2 years, like it's sort of a much maligned thing that's now used by everyone. And I think we started to use them a little bit more. We had an app pre-pandemic that we took offline and with the intention of bringing it right back. And then we've been able to approximate a lot of that through improved website, QR codes, etc. And so there's certainly those pieces, but otherwise it's kind of the same. Like each of our stores is radically different. This store is kind of the most aberrant of the three, where it's smaller. You know, this space inclusive of the basement is 7,500 feet. Our space in Plano is 14,000. And then our space in Austin is 10,500. That's about right for us. And it's got the sort of right layout, the right sort of natural light. But, you know, when you come across an opportunity to be at the entrance to Chelsea Market, you don't typically pass it up. And so I recorded an interview live on Bloomberg at the end of 2018 saying that we weren't going to open in New York for 3 or 4 years. And then later that day, we got this opportunity and it was our second store, like 6 months later. And so, you know, I think the thesis around stores has been just sort of affirmed to a sense. And like, you know, I think really for us now, it's about finding the right balance of brands, categories, the maturity of a brand, the newness of a brand, etc. And so I think there's more and more for us to be done there. And I think something that's really important for us is that we recognize that a lot of the reason we're afforded the opportunity to exist is because a lot of larger retailers lost, to a certain extent, self-awareness, right? And sort of templatized a lot of the design and just sort of rolled out on the basis of name of a location and just kept doing the same thing over and over and sort of lost track of like customer behavior. And so I think for us, you know, we're three in and all of them were built pre-pandemic. And so I think there's now this opportunity for us to really ask a lot of questions around like, okay, what does that look like from here? And I think it looks very similar, but it's going to be really driven by the feature set of a given location and how we can meet opportunity with brands, right? Because I think a lot of brands look at real estate and physical retail more as like, oh, I'm going to open in Soho, then I'm going to open in XYZ space in LA. And it's just kind of like this sort of paint by numbers sort of approach. And given the fact that we opened our first one in Plano, it sort of shows that we're not thinking that way. But I think that's very much the opportunity. So looking through the middle of the country, looking in markets that have that sort of pent up demand, looking within markets like in LA or otherwise where there is a lot of presence, but working out where we can do something differently, like we've done here in Chelsea, like we did in Austin. And so that's where we go.
There are a lot of brands right now that are specifically looking in the suburbs. And it sounds like, you know, Plano is more or less, it's not a suburb. It's more of a suburb than I'd say New York City. So are you looking into, are you hearing that? Are you thinking about that? You said that there are more locations on the horizon. Like, do you have a list of 4 places you think they're going to be?
Oh, yeah. I mean, like, we've always had the same sort of list of places that get us excited. And it's, you know, it's, you know, like in California, there's a couple of markets that are very exciting that we're looking at. And then there's, you know, the Atlantas and Nashvilles and Denvers and Seattles that are just very energizing to a lot of different brands for a lot of obvious reasons. You know, there's Chicago's and otherwise. And I think you think about a lot of those markets and you think about the most obvious sort of areas within them. But there's a lot of satellites or suburban markets that are very compelling as well. And so, you know, I think for us, what we hear from a lot of brands right now is, you know, this, it's always been the same thing, which is that customer acquisition cost is just going up and up and up. And there was reprieve during the pandemic for a minute, but it's now much worse. And so everyone's thinking about distribution channels, everyone's thinking about profitability, everyone's thinking about how they can have a physical strategy where opening a store in the right location can be drastically less expensive than running an ad campaign each month, and drive a more loyal customer and more of a return and otherwise. And so I think everyone's thinking about it. I think the general sort of reasons why we exist, that we can help in those sort of scenarios, remains extremely relevant, right? Where opening a store is really hard. Finding the right distribution partner, really hard. I mean, you heard about it just prior to this. And so I think for us, it's really just how we meet the moment now.
I feel like you're in a unique space in terms of, you probably talk to different brands and you hear whatever it is, the pain point du jour. And like, I'm sure a lot of them are talking about iOS 14. A few years ago, they were talking about Facebook CPCs going through the roof. What are you hearing now in terms of when brands are like, this is why I need to diversify more?
Yeah, I mean, it's just, I mean, everyone wants to be profitable. I mean, it's ultimately it. Which is a good goal. we have the same one. And so I think it's all the same things. I mean, the prevailing winds of like the iOS change and otherwise, I think what's interesting about those sorts of conversations is that it's very tempting to go down the road of how do you compensate for the fact that you don't get as much data from something like Facebook as a result of the iOS change. And there's a lot of this sort of compensation around, well, it's going to cost more and otherwise. But I think there's a more interesting conversation to be had around what sort of opportunity that is. Because for the majority of brands we work with and a lot of these others out in the space, their value system tends to be fairly progressive and they would be more privacy minded. They generally, if you ask them on an individual basis how they feel about being tracked on their phones, they'd probably say that they don't love it. But from a business perspective, they tend to be kind of hooked on it. And so I think there's a lot of opportunity there, and stores are a big component of that, where you can get a lot of data and you can get it in a very dignified and privacy-oriented way and in a very respectful way of the consumer. And so I think there'll be an interesting conversation to be had there. But otherwise, I mean, the concerns are the same. I mean, we talk about direct-to-consumer brands and DTC and all these different things, and it's really just, you know, I'm hardly the first person to say this. I'm certainly not. You know, it's just that the DTC thing is more of an aesthetic than it is a business model, right? That like, they're just, it's just brands are brands, right? And it's just, they happen to be more values oriented and distributing themselves in a different way and more storytelling oriented and otherwise, which is all very, very important. But it just now comes down to a question of what is the right distribution for you? What is the right strategy for physical for you? Because you probably do need it in some form. And so it may not be neighborhood goods. It may not be your own stores. It might be neighborhood goods. It might be going in a really traditional route with a marketplace. I don't know. It's going to be entirely subjective. There's no blueprint. But I think in many respects, it's a fairly perennial problem.
What is the data that you share from neighborhood good transactions with your merchants? And how does, like, I imagine it's probably a much hotter commodity right now, specifically because it's in a high intent purchaser and you get to know what they want and that kind of stuff.
Yeah, I mean, we just get data around like traffic into the stores, demographics and otherwise. I'm not capturing anything personally identifiable. We're not doing any facial recognition or anything like that. But generally, we get a sense of demographics, traffic, those sorts of things. Here, what's useful is knowing the volume of traffic immediately around us as well. So passerby, both inside the market and outside, because it's a ridiculous amount of people. And then, you know, when you transact, if you're opting in to share your information with the brand, then we'll pass along an email address and otherwise, but we're not sort of like giving like all this granular data and everything else. A lot of what's particularly useful to brands is more qualitative feedback about their brands on the floor. So like, you know, it used to be, I remember when we first opened in Plano, the person that was working in the stadium goods space was literally on a texting basis with the two co-founders at Stadium Goods, just going back and forth about what they were hearing on the fly, about what colors were most popular, what stuff was really in demand that we didn't have in the space because it was a fairly particular assortment. We have the same thing now with Fashion File. And so it's very much around, what are we hearing about what is and isn't resonating on the floor? And that stuff's really hard to come by. And yeah, so we get a lot. there's probably more we could do with it. I think we've been in this sort of mindset over the past couple of years about being in a more defensive mindset around that sort of stuff, and sort of just trying to be more focused on core objectives with the space itself and getting brands in front of people and fulfilling the core objectives. And there's more we could do to capture more information and otherwise if we so chose. But and so maybe we'll go down that route, but we're never going to be in the position where we're going to be doing it in a gross way.
Yeah. We're just about out of time, but I wanted to sort of ask one last question from me, which is, for the year to come, what are your primary goals? Are you going to open a new store by the end of the year? What are you seeking out new types of brands? What are you thinking about?
Yeah, it's a bit of everything. I mean, I think it's like fulfilling the promise of 2020 in some respects, right? We're like South by Southwest, right? We just had it. It was meant to be our third. And so we brought back a lot of the events we had been thinking about having then. And we sort of got into that sort of rhythm and really got to sort of have a lot of fun with that space. And so the folks on that team that have been there from the beginning, that worked there for 24 hours before it closed, this is this incredible feeling to sort of be able to go into this stuff that's been so long a component of the story and the pitch, but has not been so much the lived experience of it. And so I think it's about how we sort of go after a lot of these things that seem kind of almost mundane from that sort of perspective, but are really exciting because we haven't been able to do them so much through the pandemic. And then we're thinking about expansion. I think how we sort of think about fleshing out more of these categories in interesting ways, where it started out where there'd be sort of one brand in a category and now there's, you know, 5 to 10 probably. And it's how we think about creating consistency in these categories in a store that, because it changes all the time, is otherwise inconsistent. And so how can we sort of stabilize those categories with what we see to be best in class, as well as having this mix of brands that change in and out? Private label is a big one for us, which has been sort of very successful. We don't have a distinct team that does it. It's really run in large part by my chief of staff, Ashley, and it's become one of our most successful sort of revenue streams in concert with and in support of a lot of the other things inside the store. And so we've been doing a lot of exclusives with brands like The Arrivals. We just launched a restock of a collaboration we did with Recess Pickleball, which sold out instantly last year. And so we're doing a lot in that sort of space. But I think it's just sort of a continuation in many respects. And yeah, thinking about growth again and thinking about how we continue to try to mature.
Amazing. Well, Matt, thank you so much. This has been great.
Yeah, thank you.
And thank you for listening to this episode of the Modern Retail Podcast, a show by Digiday. If you haven't already, please do subscribe and send this podcast over to a friend who you know would enjoy it. See you next week.